and thank you to you all, and good afternoon. I realise it's the last session, the last paper in the last session, so we'll try and keep this nice and brief. In many ways, my presentation here carries on quite directly from Felix Inderhinder's paper yesterday. Those of you who heard Felix speak also on the Great Lakes, and also on from Bert Engelaer's paper. What I really want to look at is the phenomenon of local transitional justice in the African Great Lakes, but also to connect this phenomenon of local justice to what we're seeing as international trends in the region. And I think this intersection now between the international and the local is quite important, and it's throwing up some crucial challenges for transitional justice in this part of Africa. What I'm going to draw on here really are findings from my own qualitative research over the last 6 or 7 years. I've made about 15, 16 trips now to the Great Lakes, engaging really with three different levels of transitional justice institutions, the local, the national, and the international. I'm not going to talk too much about the national here, really just focus on the other two. I've now done about 1,000 interviews with different participants in these processes, from government officials all the way down to the judges involved in the different processes I'm going to talk about. Day-to-day civilians who are engaged in those practices. So really what I'm trying to do in my analysis, I guess, is to try and glean an understanding of these processes from as many different sources as possible. Now, this usually means lugging a rucksack around sort of small redundant villages, a rucksack that also has to contain a suit and a tie, so that, you know, when I turn up in Kigali or Kinshasa or Kampala, I have to get scrubbed up to talk to government officials. So that combination of approaches and methodologies, I guess, raises some challenges in and of themselves. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. My material here really draws on two monographs that I have coming out of the next year. One on the Gacaca process in Rwanda, a process that I've been looking at really from day one, from the inception of Gacaca right through to the present. And the second book that looks at the International Criminal Court, particularly in Congo and Uganda. And that's a book really that tries to not just look at the court itself, but to put the court in the political and social and cultural context of those two countries. And also, crucially, to look at the way in which the ICC is actually rubbing up against other transitional justice processes in those countries and some of the complications that come out of that. Really what I want to do just in the next sort of 15 minutes or so is just very briefly to speak about some of the methodologies and some of the problems I think that are involved in this type of fieldwork, looking at these types of issues. And then to look at what I think are some of the common virtues and some of the common problems of local justice in particular, in the three countries that I'm going to look at, Rwanda, Congo, and Uganda. And a big part of that challenge, I think, is how local justice actually does connect or doesn't connect with international approaches to transitional justice. Now, in terms of the three countries that I'm looking at, I don't think I really need to give much background on the conflicts involved, because you're already very familiar with them. We've also covered these three countries, I think, quite extensively in the conference so far. But of course, in the Great Lakes, we're talking about interlocking conflicts in many cases. So I think it's important to look at these three countries in particular in a regional sense, because not only do the sources of the conflict overlap, but something that I'm going to suggest is that I think transitional justice in many ways has begun to overlap in these three places in very crucial ways. Of course, we're talking about a post-genocide situation in Rwanda. We're dealing with a whole series of ongoing conflicts in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Conflicts that, at least in the recent era, stem back really to land disputes in the Kivu provinces in 1993 and leading onwards. Of course, those conflicts have a much longer history than that. And in the case of northern Uganda, of course, we're talking about a civil war situation which seems to have abated somewhat, at least in the terms of northern Uganda, but we're now dealing with a conflict that in many ways has been displaced to other parts of the region, with the move now of the Lord's Resistance Army into northeastern Congo, continuing hostilities in Central African Republic and southern Sudan. So that's certainly not a resolved conflict, but one that really has morphed in a whole range of ways. So in terms of local transitional justice in these three countries, well, what are we talking about particularly? Well, obviously in the case of Rwanda, I'm going to talk a little bit about Gacaca, and again, I don't need to introduce that institution, because we've already had that done quite adeptly by both Felix and Bert. But I think it is important to highlight right at the outset that I think Gacaca in many ways has become a touchstone for all of these discussions of local transitional justice, particularly in Africa. And something that I'm going to mention in just a moment is how explicitly Gacaca is now being used as a model, or at least a discussive point, in other places in the region and Africa as a whole. In the case of Congo, the institution I'm going to focus on is called the Baraza Intercommunautaire. And the Baraza, in essence, is a conflict resolution institution that is used now exclusively in North Kivu. Really, what the Baraza has done has been to bring together the leaders of the nine major ethnic groups in North Kivu, whose role really has been to try and resolve disputes at the community level before they escalate to mass violence. The Baraza was established in 1998. It began as a government tool. The newly arrived Laurent Kabila government established a whole range of conflict resolution institutions in North Kivu. And the Baraza, through a whole very complicated process, really sort of separated itself from the government apparatus and became this community-based practice. And the leaders of the Baraza would go around community to community, actively attempting to resolve conflicts as they arose. And land, in particular, in North Kivu was a crucial source of most of these conflicts. And what we saw with the Baraza in North Kivu between 1998 and really 2001-2002 was that there were no cases of serious land disputes within the sphere of influence of the Baraza. And this was something that was also picked up on by a whole range of international actors, including an EU mission to North Kivu at the end of 2001, which commented on the effectiveness of the Baraza. And I think the commissioners on that tour found that quite a surprising phenomenon. What we've seen, though, in the last 2 or 3 years is that the Baraza now actually has collapsed entirely. So we're now talking about a completely defunct institution. The causes of that collapse are much too elaborate for me to go into here, but in essence what it boils down to is that the same divisions between ethnic groups within North Kivu became to manifest themselves within the Baraza itself. So the Baraza in no way was able to insulate itself from the wider political and social problems that it was trying to resolve. And so at the end of 2005, the end of 2006, that the Baraza ceased to operate. There have been a whole range of attempts to try and revive the institution. Quite interestingly, it's been the UN peacekeeping mission in Eastern Congo, MONUC, which has been predominantly attempting to revive the Baraza, which has been in and of itself quite a strange phenomenon to see a whole range of international actors who in many cases have problems of legitimacy themselves now trying to get the leaders of these nine ethnic groups to cooperate in some sort of harmonious fashion. And of course, in the case of Northern Uganda, there's been a raging debate over the potential use of local rituals to cleanse combatants coming back from the bush, to try and reintegrate these individuals back into society and to contribute to reconciliation as a whole. These debates, I guess, reached some sort of crescendo during the Juba peace talks, which, as I mentioned in my introductory comments the other day, I think, it really engendered this very unhelpful debate about international versus local justice. You know, these very quickly became debates almost between different football teams. And I remember spending a lot of time in northern Uganda and southern Sudan at the time that the talks really were beginning. And there was a sense in the discourse that you almost had to pick a side. It was, who were you barracking for? You know, did you see yourself as an advocate of the ICC? Or did you reject the international approach and see that there was a community-based or a grassroots approach that might be more valid? My sense was that was a very unhelpful way of thinking about these things. It didn't give us a very good analytical framework in which to actually assess these different institutions and what they might be trying to achieve. There's been a tendency in that debate in northern Uganda to preference Acholi rituals, which has been highly problematic, and I'll talk about that in a second. Of course, these three processes in these three countries are much more complicated than I've been able to kind of sketch here. But for the sake of this presentation, really what I want to do is try and pick out, I think, some of the salient features of all three to give a sense of what are some of the common challenges and potentially some of the common virtues of these institutions. Now, just a very brief comment, I suppose, about methodologies relating to how should we actually explore these types of institutions. And But I think it's important that we recognise that we are talking about very particular approaches to transitional justice here, and perhaps approaches that we don't automatically have the methodological tools to address. And I think for those of us who are working in this field of local approaches to transitional justice, it's been a big challenge for us all to try and work out how do we appropriately deal with this phenomenon. And the reason for that is that these institutions in many ways have taken on a life of their own. You know, they're not very easily characterisable. In the case of Gacaca, the Baza, and also the debates about rituals in Uganda, what we're seeing is, yes, institutions that have some kind of traditional resonance, and of course that's a very loaded term and one that we've debated in this conference. But these, crucially, are institutions that have been turned on their head in response to mass conflict. They've been transformed, in some cases they've been codified. The role of the state has been absolutely central to how these institutions have functioned. And so what that means is that we're not dealing, again, with very easily categorised processes. They have some historical basis, they resonate in a cultural way. Political environments matter an enormous amount. And so we have to develop a robust methodology that can contend with all of these different elements. I think there's been a range of problems associated with the way that local transitional justice has been dealt with, particularly in Central Africa. I think in the last few years, there's been a tendency by a lot of commentators and analysts looking at these types of processes to either completely romanticise what we're seeing or to completely demonise them. And again, this has become a very polarised literature, I think. But for example, in the early days of Gacaca, there was a kind of flurry of articles about the wonderful Rwandan attempt to revive a traditional reconciliation process, and that this would inherently resonate with entire swathes of the population because, of course, Rwandans had practiced Gacaca for centuries, and so this new post-genocide version of Gacaca would connect at a deep level. And I think we've probably seen that debate go even a step further in the case of northern Uganda, where there's been an enormous literature talking about the inherently forgiving and reconciliatory nature of northern Ugandan societies, which would therefore make the population feel deeply connected to the rituals that were being discussed. I was on a Kenya Airways flight last year. This was actually when OTJR was giving some technical advice to the Ugandan peace talks. And with Lydia Bosiri and another colleague, I was sitting on a flight sort of reading this recently released report on northern Uganda by an NGO that I won't name for the time being, at least. And about halfway through this report, there was a section talking about the ways in which northern Uganda had been characterised to date. And one of the problems that this report identified was a tendency to essentialise particularly a Acholi culture. A problem of essentialising the culture as inherently reconciliatory and forgiving, and that this had kind of skewed these debates in very problematic ways. And I sat there and I read this report and I agreed wholeheartedly with that paragraph. I thought that's exactly right. This has been a massive problem. But in this case, the deeper problem was that the NGO concern had published at least six reports previously in which they essentialised the Acholi culture in precisely that way. This NGO was probably more than anybody else responsible for creating this false view of what Acholi culture was supposed to be. So there was sort of a crucial element of bad faith there, I thought. I think there's often also been a tendency to talk about local processes purely in legal terms. And so again, in the case of Gacaca, what we've seen, I think, is a dominant literature that focuses on due process elements and other legal aspects of the Gacaca process. Now, those issues are crucial because, of course, Gacaca is a legal phenomenon. It is codified in law. It operates as a court system. It can prosecute and hand down very severe sentences. So the legal aspects are crucial. But I think, as Burke has suggested in much of his analysis, Gacaca, of course, is much more than that. Gacaca is a life experience. This is something that people live through. They participate in it. And so I think to understand something like Gacaca, we need a methodology that can also contend with that. Yes, let's look at it from a legal point of view, but what is the experience of the people who are actually going through this? And I think that second issue, that second category of questions is much more complicated and requires a completely different approach to analysing Gacaca. I mean, I would highlight, I think, Amnesty International's reports on Gacaca as an example of perhaps how we should not examine this particular institution. To date, we still await an Amnesty International report on Gacaca that refers to a single concrete hearing. The approach that Amnesty has taken has been to talk about Gacaca in these very broad terms, raising these due process concerns. But where's the observations of hearings? Where's the evidence from identifiable people and places so that we can actually wrestle with that? That to me is a category error. It's not dealing with Gacaca as it actually functions. Byrne, I think, absolutely hit the point when he said, what we also need to do, goodness gracious me, time flies, what we also need to do is look at these practices in a wide range of locations. And I think particularly in Rwanda, there's been a tendency to do what you might call Kentucky tour fieldwork. There have become these kind of tourist gachachas, often very close to Kigali, where researchers kind of flock. And as a result of that, we've seen a whole range of very redundant analyses, which are telling us the same thing from the same places. And of course, what's tended to happen is that those gachacha hearings themselves have changed and morphed because of how commonly they're observed. So, there's always a flow back of phenomena here. And I think methodologically it's also crucial that we look at these practices over time, because they develop and they take on a life of their own, because again, they are very much a lived experience. So very quickly, and of course, as always, I've left the substance of my talk until the very, very end to try and cram it into about 5 minutes. Just very briefly, I think I want to point out what I'm seeing as some of the common virtues and some of the common problems with local approaches to transitional justice in the Great Lakes. In terms of the virtues of these practices, and I'm going to speak very generally here and make a couple of specific comments, but we can pick up a bit more on specificity in the Q&A, I think. I really see three main virtues to the way that Gacaca, the Baaza, and the Ugandan rituals have played out. I think, firstly, there's been a very important emphasis within all of these practices on direct engagement and contact between individuals intimately involved in violence. I think this is something that characterises these practices inherently, and I think it has been one of their greatest virtues, although not an entirely positive one. What these practices in essence say is that if we're going to deal with conflict, if we're going to resolve it, if we're going to try and reconcile people after violence, then we need to get them into a space where they can see one another face to face and actually wrestle with the details of what they've been through. It's not enough to do these things at a distance. It's not enough to do these things in a separate way from the way that people live their lives. There has to be this face-to-face engagement. Now, engagement is by no means a universal good. I mean, I've been to plenty of Gacaca hearings that have broken out into fist fights, which you could argue is a very direct form of engagement. It's hardly a positive one. But I think, in essence, what we're seeing is that there are serious virtues to this approach to doing transitional justice, bringing people into that space. And secondly, something that I think we've seen in these local practices as well is that it's not just about engagement, it's about the discursive space that then is created. And in the case of all of these practices, but I think particularly in Gacaca and the Ugandan rituals, something that has been very important has been the ability for victims to express themselves directly about experiences of conflict. This is something that I've been hearing now for 6 or 7 years in many communities around Rwanda, is that for victims in particular, one of the great virtues of Gacaca is that it allows them to tell their own stories in their own terms. And crucially, this gives them a sense of public acknowledgement. And also what we've seen, I think, in a lot of places is that there's been a sense of solidarity amongst people built up because of this discursiveness. So what I get in a lot of my interviews is a response from many victims in which they say, it's not just that I got to stand up at Gacaca and tell my story, but I heard other victims tell their story. And what we found was that actually our experiences were quite similar. We hadn't necessarily talked about these things directly in the years leading up to Gacaca. The events were traumatic. Tension and mistrust in the community is rife, as Bird's already suggested. But in Gacaca, we had a sense to stand up and tell our story and to feel some sense of commonality with others. And I think for a lot of victims in Rwanda, a lot of survivors in Rwanda, that's been very important. The discursive space in Gacaca, however, is also replicated, and that I think needs to be emphasized as well. think that the problematic nature sometimes of the discussion that takes place at Vichacha. One of the challenges for the Vichacha process is that it really pursues a combination of legal and non-legal objectives. And this has been, I think, one of the great challenges for the process, is how do you bring people into a space to talk about the genocide and allow people the space to tell their stories in a way that they see as appropriate, but also gain very crucial legal outcomes from this. And there was a hearing I went to in a little village just down near the Burundian border about 2.5 years ago. And a genocide suspect had been brought from a local jail. And the week before, he'd confessed to a whole range of genocide crimes. And he stood up in front of his community and he basically repeated the confession that he had made to the prison authorities. And in essence, what he said was that he had pillaged a whole range of property from a house on the outskirts of the community. And he gave this very elaborate explanation about how he'd been responsible for these property crimes. Now, what he was doing was really confessing to the lowest level crimes that you possibly can in the Vichacha framework. So at best, he was probably going to receive some sort of community service as a punishment. So this man ended his narrative, and an old lady at the back of the room, she put her hand up and waited for the judges to allow her to speak. And she then stood, and she looked at the judges, and she looked at this man, and then she said, "This man's lying. And not only is he lying, but these judges are incompetent because they should know that he's lying." And there's sort of 150 people who were sitting there were kind of flabbergasted. You know, who was this lady and how could she possibly berate the judges like this? And the judges asked her to elaborate. And she said, "Well, you should know that he's lying because we've already dealt with this case. We already know that this property was stolen. We know who was responsible for it. And I," the lady said, "I should know because that's my house." And as there was this backwards and forwards conversation between the General Assembly and the judges and the suspect involved, it came out that, in fact, this man had lied. In actual fact, what we were dealing with was a completely innocent man who had been in jail for a very, very lengthy period, who had decided to confess to very low-level crimes in jail because that was the best means of him to get out of jail into the justice process. So he was gambling. There was a calculation going on here. As a result of this, he was convicted of perjury and imprisoned for 2 years. He just got it wrong. But what that suggests here is that the truth process in something like the Vichacha is very complicated. And this combination of trying to do non-legal and legal things simultaneously is very, very tough, right? I'm going to wrap this up very, very quickly. Challenges, because there are lots of them. I mean, it's going to be in the paper, but I think just to highlight a couple of things. I think one of the most important issues when we're dealing with local practices in transition of justice, and particularly in the Great Lakes, is this issue of the sensitisation and the legitimacy that these processes have. And I think what we've seen, particularly in the case of Vichacha and also in the Ugandan case, is an enormous fluctuation in popular perceptions towards these practices. I think in the early years of Vichacha, there was a huge amount of optimism about what this institution could bring. But over time, Vichacha continues to change. There have been more modifications to this law than you can count. And so I think a lot of Rwandans are very confused about what the practice is and what it's supposed to do. There's a very complicated situation in Rwanda now where, in several communities I've been to, you can see the current version of Vichacha dealing with genocide crimes alongside the traditional version of Vichacha, which was used to deal with a whole range of day-to-day disputes, along with a new institution called the Albunzi, which is a kind of completely, you know, reformed version of day-to-day dispute resolution, again to deal with another set of day-to-day crimes. As of a month ago, the Rwandan government also began to talk about using the current Vichacha structure to basically deal with day-to-day crimes in the future. So this institution geared towards dealing with genocide crimes is about to wrap up in the next couple of months, but the structure of it is probably going to be kept and then used onwards for the next 2, 3, 4 years. So you are sometimes dealing with communities with about 4 of these processes going on simultaneously, and I think it's fair to say people are often utterly baffled by what's going on. And in northern Uganda, one of the big problems has been, I think, in terms of local rituals, is rituals don't always have an inherent cultural resonance. I think this came up slightly in Stephen Fuller's presentation today, that one of the symptoms of the conflict in northern Uganda has been that crucial cultural and social structures have broken down. Customary leaders don't always have the same credence or the same status that they once had. So it's not clear that reviving these institutions now is inherently going to resonate with people. So it's difficult sometimes to know what the source of legitimacy is going to be. Just finally, as I alluded to at the start, one of the crucial elements, I think, when we look at local justice in the Great Lakes is how is it connecting with international processes? And I'm going to end off on this point. And this, I think, is a big challenge for the processes themselves and those who are in charge of them. It's also a big challenge for those of us who are analysing these practices. This space has changed now. We're seeing a whole range of actors working side by side. And the local and the international are clashing up against each other in many ways. In the case of Rwanda, what we've seen is increasingly investigators from the ICTR coming to Gacaca jurisdictions looking for evidence. And what we're seeing increasingly in ICTR judgments is the use of Gacaca evidence. And this is having an effect, I think, in many places, certainly a series of places in different regions that I've looked at, in the way that information is being given and recorded within the Gacaca jurisdictions themselves. I mean, just 6 months ago, a Gacaca judge said to me that he'd had 5 or 6 meetings with ICTR investigators. And he said, the problem now is we have to keep dumbing down this information for these guys. He said, up to this point, we've been able to record these very elaborate, often very complicated narratives that we're gaining from people. And this is important for our understanding of the genocide. But because these lawyers keep coming to us, what we've had to do is we've had to change the way that we record the information. Even during the hearings themselves, we have to make it more bite-sized, more didactic, so that these investigators can understand what the hell we're on about. So it's interesting, I think, to see the impact that this has happened. I think as Nikki Palmer mentioned in her paper yesterday, of course, we're often seeing the same participants involved in these different institutions. So the same witnesses often are telling their testimonies in Gacaca and sometimes telling very different testimonies at the ICTR. This poses challenges for both institutions. In terms of Uganda, of course, we've seen an enormous debate about the impact of local and international rubbing up against each other. Could we get to a stage, potentially, where the ICC could not open investigations in a country because there was a robust grassroots-level process underway? This is something that's been considered in Uganda. I think that's something we have to think about is, do we have a legal framework that can capture these institutions? Because I think it's only a matter of time before we see a government say, there's no place for the ICC here because we have grassroots practice. In the case of Congo, again, there's been this very difficult combination of Monuc as a peacekeeping force operating alongside the Baraza. There was also an enormous confusion between the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was set up in Congo and lasted about 18 months before it collapsed, which was overlapping with the Baraza, and there was no clear delineation between them. So these raise questions about coordination. How do we allow a space potentially for these different institutions to do very, very different things? But who coordinates and how does that take place? I've gone drastically over time, and I do apologise, but I hope there was at least something coherent.